und herzlich willkommen. Greetings to all listeners and welcome to the first episode of this new season of The New Germany. This special series is part of our History and Politics podcast, which explores the interplay between history and modern day politics. My name is Gabrielle Wojdelko, and I'd like to warmly welcome our two hosts, Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who will be guiding you through the intellectual tapestry of our past and present times. We start this new series of The New Germany with a distinguished guest. Peter Altmaier is with us, a long-standing politician, a former minister who has held many important political functions in the different governments under German Chancellor Angela Merkel. With Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody at the helm, we will delve into an in-depth analysis of Germany's past and present challenges. Unfortunately, there is some noise in the recording that we were unable to edit out, for which we apologize very much. Thank you for your understanding. And now, over to you, Katja and Oliver, ready to embark on a journey of insight with Peter Altmaier.
Hello and welcome back to The New Germany, a special series for the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast, looking at what Germany's past can tell us about its present and its future. Those of you who have been listening to us for the first two seasons will know that up to now we've been trying to decipher the Zeitenwende, the dawn of a new era, declared by the Chancellor Olaf Scholz 3 days after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year.
But now, nearly 2 years down the line, the stakes of the game have changed. The right-wing Alternative for Germany party, or AfD, is polling at more than 20% of the vote and has built a commanding lead in the running for three crucial East German state elections that will be held in the autumn. The government's own economic advisers have warned that the country's growth prospects are at their lowest level on record, and the pension system is in danger of heading for meltdown. One in three of Germany's biggest companies are making preparations to shift production elsewhere, spooked by eye-watering energy bills and the broader costs of doing business in their homeland.
Economists also claim that the country needs to attract as many as 1.5 million foreign workers a year to have a hope, or any hope really, of sustaining its prosperity. But at the same time, Scholz has announced a new German hardness towards asylum seekers as their numbers approach levels last seen in the 2015 migration crisis. The polls paint a picture of a nation racked by concerns and internal conflicts about immigration and integration, energy and climate change, inflation, social justice, and the future of the economy. Only 27% of German voters now trust the state to do its job well. 69% say it's overwhelmed.
So, against this backdrop of broad-spectrum pessimism and uncertainty, the term Zeitenwende no longer feels entirely adequate. What we're really talking about here is a stormy transformation at every level of society, with little sense of where things are going or how they might conceivably turn out to be better than before. At the end of each year since 1949, the Allensbach Polling Institute has asked Germans whether they look forward to the 12 months ahead with more hope or fear. And the last time the level of hope was this low was in 1950. This is a national crisis of identity and faith with bells on.
Well, that was cheerful. I feel like we need a lie down and a Helles already. A stormy transformation at every level of society.
You make me sound so Churchillian there. I'm quite flaccid. We overdid it a bit. It did all sound like the start of an Asterix comic, didn't it? These are one small village of indomitable Brandenburgers still holds out against the invaders.
All right, Björn Höcke. Anyway, that Cassandra over there is Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin.
And those strident Prussian tones belong to Katja Heuer, a German-British historian now living in Norfolk?
Yeah, Norfolk. And why not? You sound surprised.
How would you describe Norfolk for our sizable contingent of German listeners?
Well, I sort of rather suspect if I was inclined to make Freudian analyses of my own psyche, that I probably replicated the situation I lived in Germany, where the sort of flat wide landscapes of Brandenburg, being just outside of Berlin, was kind of my environment. And now I live in flat, wide landscapes not far from London. That seems to be the theme here. So yeah, very rural, lots of sheep, lots of walking, pubs. It's a nice place to be, and not too far out. People are always a bit surprised when I say that I live in Norfolk and, you know, you're somewhere in London, but actually it isn't a world away.
Yeah, good potato country.
That too.
Believe your local MP is now one Elizabeth Truss, who might be able to tell you a thing or two about leadership in a time of crisis.
I was delighted to find that out myself. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what to make of that yet, whether the comedy factor is bigger than the despair. But we'll see where that's going after the next election.
All right, back to Germany. This does feel like an unusually propitious moment to be doing a history-flavoured podcast. Because if you read about what the country's been through over the past 8 decades or so, it's really startling how many of the things we mentioned at the start of this episode are not really new.
No, that is true, and it often, maybe it's me as a historian thinking that way, but I'm often surprised how often people think, you know, that they're onto a new problem or something that has never happened before. You know, the word unprecedented is used a lot in the media. Most of us historians sit there and go, no, not unprecedented at all. This did happen at some point in history before. I think quite often we're reluctant almost to look at historical examples when actually, you know, they are quite revealing in terms of not just the problems that have presented themselves before, but also the way that people responded to them. I think it was Mark Twain who said history doesn't repeat, but it often rhymes. And I think that's a good sort of adage to go by. There's a lot to be learned from history, even without, you know, directly sort of taking examples and using them as a one-to-one kind of case. But there is a lot of, you know, patterns and trends that have obviously been the case before, particularly with the problems that we're now facing, things like you know, inflation, political extremism, upheaval. All of those things aren't new, of course.
Mark Twain also had a lot of things to say about Germany, but that's probably a subject for another episode. What we're going to do here in this season is take a look at 7 aspects of Germany's present metamorphosis, from industry and social change to political extremism and relations with its closest allies, and ask from a historical perspective, how deep is the crisis really? Where did it come from? And how might you get out of it? And we are going to start today with the role of the Chancellor.
Yeah, and before we go through our roster of 4 crisis chancellors, though, I think it might be a good idea to ask what a crisis actually really is and who gets to define it.
Yeah, if you're in journalism and you're lucky, you will have an editor who pushes back a bit whenever you get the urge to describe something as a crisis, because we do have an unfortunate tendency to catastrophize a bit, and crucially, a crisis does come with its own internal logic of an imperative for immediate and decisive action. Action this day, as Churchill would have put it, which is sometimes to the detriment of actual strategic thinking or concentrating on other problems. And I think a sceptical approach is particularly important at a time when there is a general sense that we're living in a polycrisis, a kind of pile-up of multiple global comorbidities that overlap and make each other worse. Because the danger here is that you tip over into a condition of permacrisis, where politics is constantly twitching on edge and lurching from one drastic bad decision to the next. And I think the current palaver over asylum seekers in Germany is quite a good example of that. Because at the time we are recording this episode, it looks very much as though Germany is going to have registered more than 300,000 first-time asylum applications by the end of 2023, which would be the highest number since the peak in 2015-2016. And that's coming on top of the best part of 1 million war refugees from Ukraine. And a lot of German voters are obviously very worried about this, and pressure is built up on the state and federal governments to find some kind of dramatic and easy-sounding solution, like putting a cap on the number of people who can apply for asylum, or setting up an offshore asylum processing centre somewhere like Libya or Egypt or Lebanon. And I think it's to Olaf Scholz's credit here that he has resisted the temptation to call it a crisis, because this issue is not only exceedingly difficult to solve, but also pretty likely to be with us for years to come. And so you have Scholz acknowledging the public concern and coining the phrase new German hardness for how he intends to deal with it. But at the same time, his kind of central metaphor for immigration controls is as a kind of very complicated machine with hundreds of these tiny screws, each of which looks a bit insignificant on its own. But if you turn enough of them the right way, you'll make a difference. Now, is this avoidance of melodrama clever electoral politics? I mean, time will tell. But is it a reasonably honest and responsible way to deal with a very complicated and long-term problem without catastrophizing it into a crisis? I think you can make that case. So, Katja, who is the first crisis chancellor you brought along to this show and tell?
It's also somebody who approached a sort of moment in time that many felt was a moment of multiple crises all happening at the same time, an existential moment really for Germany, with a fair degree of calm and a sort of can-do attitude and a kind of willingness to try and solve the problems really, rather than approaching them with an ideological mindset. And I'm talking about Gustav Stresemann, who is arguably the crisis chancellor, if you will, because the nation really did genuinely experience a moment of crisis at that point that I don't think can be talked away as something sort of insignificant or something that wasn't as bad as it sounded. It really was bad when he became the chancellor. So the moment that happened was the 13th of August 1923, when Germany really was the German democracy anyway was certainly on the brink. So, before him, no fewer than seven other people had occupied this office of the chancellery since 1919. And they'd all failed to maintain the confidence of what was by then a very raucous and splintered parliament. Stresemann.
You almost make it sound like Britain.
Yeah, or several other countries that I can think of at this present moment in time. Yes, so Stresemann was really trying to deal with a number of different sort of strands of ideologies that were all represented in parliament at the same time. He was trying to hold together a coalition of five different parties, all trying to deal with sort of Germany's existential problems. So, for example, at the time, French and Belgian troops had just occupied the Ruhr region because they were protesting against Germany's failure to pay reparations for the First World War. Unemployment had risen to over 4 million. And in November, Adolf Hitler had also attempted to seize, will be attempting to seize power in the so-called Munich Putsch. So all of these things kind of added to not just a sense of crisis, but a genuine kind of existential crisis that the state was in at this point. On top of that, Germany was in deep economic trouble. So you had hyperinflation going on. So just to give you one example here, in November 1923, 1 kilogram of beef cost 4,800 billion marks. So this is easily one of the worst crises, I would say, that Germany ever faced. In fact, when he was asked to take over the leadership, by the way, the SPD was the largest party in this coalition, but they didn't want the chancellorship at this point. Considering it very much a sort of poison chalice. Stresemann actually wrote to his wife and said that taking this office was akin to political suicide. but somehow he still managed to look at all these different crises and sort of ride out the immediate storm anyway. So, against immense pressure and resistance from both the left and the right, he called off the anti-French strikes in the Ruhr, introduced an emergency currency to stabilize the economy, and actually began talking to France, Britain and the US about a kind of way out of the crisis that the reparations payments have caused. So even though his government was actually brought down in November of the same year, so he wasn't actually chancellor for very long, he did carry on the same work that he'd begun as foreign minister, which was a position that he held up until his death in 1929. So I suppose I'm cheating a little bit in that a lot of the Stresemann achievements actually came after he was no longer chancellor, but it was still he was still an amazing problem solver in that he sort of stabilized most of the immediate problems that Germany faced. I think some of the lessons here in terms of what we can learn from that isn't so much the kind of specific problems that Germany was facing at that time, as they are, of course, very peculiar to the 1920s. But I think the lessons to be learned from Stresemann are that he was following his own instincts. He was criticized very, very heavily from the left and the right in terms of what he was trying to do, and followed his own very considerable political acumen to try and find a way through, so almost detached from the kind of, you know, big ideological strands at the time, should Germany stick to the Treaty of Versailles or not, those kinds of things. He found a way through that was pragmatic rather than based on kind of previous thinking. And I think in that respect, he did manage to get Germany through that immediate spell of crisis. Although it's hard to tell, of course, whether in the long run that would have been successful. He actually died on the 3rd of October 1929, which was only 26 days before the Wall Street crash plunged Germany into its ultimate darkness, of course, and into the fall of the Weimar Republic. So who knows whether he would have been able to save Germany from its ultimate fate at that point. So who's your first pick? How can you beat that?
Well, I don't know if I can beat that, but let's fast forward nearly 50 years and look at how Willy Brandt, the first social democratic chancellor of West Germany, dealt with the 1973 oil crisis, pretty much slap bang on 50 years ago on the day that we're recording this. Because I think it's not only very relevant for today, but has also been described by some historians as the first true crisis of globalization. So if we set the scene, it is at this point October 1973, and 12 months earlier, Brandt has been re-elected after an epic campaign in the Bundestag election. In about 8 months' time, he's going to resign after one of his closest aides, Günter Guillaume, is outed as a spy for East Germany. And all of a sudden, a coalition of Arab countries led by Egypt and Syria launches a surprise attack on Israel, starting the Yom Kippur War, which catastrophically backfires from a military perspective. And so in an effort to pressure the West out of its support for Israel, the OPEC states cut their oil production. The price of a barrel of oil nearly doubles in a single stroke, and it's quadrupled by the end of the year. And this hammers a lot of Western countries, but it triggers a full-fat, bona fide crisis in West Germany, which at this time is dependent on OPEC for about three-quarters of its oil imports. And oil, in turn, makes up more than half of West Germany's primary energy consumption. So the bill goes up by 150% in a matter of weeks. And I know Brandt is widely revered in Germany today and sometimes tops the polls of the best chancellors in the history of the Federal Republic. But if I had to pick an image to sum up how he responded to the crisis, it would be a man stuck in a nightmare where there is a gigantic meltdown going on in the factory, and he's pulling all of the levers in the control room and they just keep snapping off in his hands. So I think a lot of the examples you can learn from this are actually negative ones. So in the very early days of the upheaval, Brandt tells the Bundestag, the crisis at whose beginning we stand is not to be trivialised. The younger generation is experiencing for the first time what a certain shortage can mean. And so his primary response there, pretty much just as Scholz and Habeck's has been in 2022, is to try and push sacrifice and energy conservation as an opportunity, a so-called sort of sixth source of energy. So you get a driving ban on these so-called car-free Sundays once a month, which a lot of Germans just ignore. And they turn out to be so radically unpopular that there are only four of them in the end. You get a blanket 100-kilometer-an-hour speed limit on the autobahns, which again is abandoned after 6 months. And aside from some of the kind of economic stabilization measures, such as short-time work, none of it really does anything. And Brandt's appeals for self-sacrifice go down like a cup of cold sick with the public. You have both the FAZ and Bild newspapers comparing them to the Nazi-era propaganda campaigns trying to get households to make rudimentary Sunday stews to save on exports. And ironically enough, this is also the period in West German history where having a shower or a bath every day becomes normalized. Something about this appeal for giving up energy use actually kind of resulting in people enjoying using more of it. At the same time, Brandt announced that West Germany won't be taking in any more Gastarbeiter or foreign guest workers because of rising domestic unemployment. This is not only terrible economics, because at that point the average Gastarbeiter contributes 10 times more to the state in taxes than they receive in benefits, but it's also a complete failure on its own terms, because the number of Turks living in West Germany actually goes up over the following decade from 900,000 to 1.5 million, because these guest workers are deciding that instead of going home and risking not being able to get back into Germany, they might as well settle down and bring their families over. And that in turn increases the drain on state resources. So broadly, I think Brandt's response to the oil crisis is a story of panicked half measures that were too drastic and not properly pitched to the public. What you do also have is some very interesting long-term consequences, because the way that West Germany tries to get out of its oil dependence on the Arab states at the time is, of course, by buying more oil from the Soviet Union. I mean, good luck with that one, guys. And on the other hand, though, the positive upshot is that it does usher in this age of rigorous energy efficiency standards for housing and household gadgets that seem completely normal now, and a short-lived renaissance of atomic energy. So it wasn't an unmitigated disaster, but I think it is certainly a study in how not to manage a polycrisis. Who's next?
Yeah, also, I mean, many of the problems seem so modern in lots of ways as well. You know, the way that we are currently again thinking about how to save energy, preserve energy, for example, you know, the way that people were asked to sort of, you know, consider when and how to heat their homes and to what temperature, the fact that public buildings were switched off, you know, at night, the lighting's on them and things like that is quite remarkable, because I think it was the same sort of thing that lots of people got quite frustrated about, is this kind of idea of state interference in the private sphere. So yes, many lessons to be learned from that, more in how not to do things, I guess.
I was just going to say, what's interesting about the way that Scholz and Habeck dealt with it is that there wasn't an equivalent really to Brandt's speech to the Bundestag telling young people that they didn't know how good they'd had it and that they were all sort of soft weaklings who needed to learn the value of self-denial. They used primarily economic incentives to kind of nudge people into cutting their energy use. And I think that is one of the ways in which Germany has actually learned from the mistakes of history. Anyway, let's get on to our next crisis chancellor.
Sure. It is actually the next crisis chancellor. We're talking about Helmut Schmidt here, the successor to Brandt, who was still very much dealing with the same issues. I did choose him nonetheless because I think, in contrast to Brandt, he's kind of the prototype of the pragmatist, if you will, somebody who comes to crisis management with a sort of, you know, cold, calculating mind, far away from emotionality or ideology, or at least that's how he presented himself in public. He famously once said that he who has visions should go and see a doctor, kind of with the idea being, you know, you look kind of for problems to solve and how to solve them, rather than kind of painting a big, diffuse sort of vision of what you're trying to achieve. So there are some interesting lessons, I think, in that, given how difficult it is for politicians today to navigate the treacherous waters of the culture wars. You know, and Schmidt basically kind of dismissed all of the ideologies that were there at the time and tried to largely deal with problems as he saw them. So, you know, we mentioned the oil crises, for example, to start with, which Brandt had a very mixed sort of success rate with. Schmidt's response to that was to rigorously cut down on social welfare, for example, and thin down the state and basically try and save money that way, which of course leads him very, very far away from the SPD's kind of core trajectory, and therefore he was you know, faced with vicious criticism from his own party for this. And nonetheless, he tried to stick to the kind of whole idea of the welfare state. So he was still calling it Europe's greatest achievements of the 20th century, but did sort of cut down on individual measures in the hope that that would kind of relieve the financial problems on the on the state is something that we see SPD chancellors, for example, Gerhard Schröder, do again later on. And it's, of course, is still a huge debate today as to, in terms of what the state can afford, in terms of handouts and benefits. The oil crisis also, as you just mentioned, highlighted another problem that seems very familiar today in terms of energy. And as you say, it made Germany more reliant on cheap fossil fuels from Russia. And Schmidt's answer to this was actually a different one, namely nuclear energy. He looked at this and was again faced with huge criticism from his own party and from that side of politics, and argued that, and I quote, "I find this astonishing that among the great industrial states of the world, from the US to China, Japan and Russia, the Germans are the only ones who believe that they can cope without nuclear energy." And it's once again a question that hasn't really gone away. Many states are now looking to nuclear energy again as a means of, you know, independent energy production that can be comparatively environmentally friendly, at least what in terms of emissions, as far as emissions are concerned. And it is a question that wasn't solved then, and it's not going to be solved now. But it is interesting that he was willing to move so far away from his own, you know, field to try and pursue a way that would have led to greater energy independence for Germany. And then, of course, the biggest threat that, or the biggest crisis on a political level that Schmidt faced during his tenure, and perhaps the thing that defined it, was far-left terrorism from the so-called Red Army faction, who were responsible for the murder of over 30 people and then tried to get some of their own people out of prison by blackmailing the government into releasing them through captured or kidnapping people, basically, and taking them hostage. And Schmidt's response to this was a very, very hardline, uncompromising stance, which risked, obviously, the lives of the hostages. But in the end, I think, did actually bring this whole thing to an end, because there was literally no point in negotiating with the government over this if the government says we're not negotiating with terrorists. That's, again, something, of course, not quite as severe today, but it is still a thing that the government has to consider when it comes to things, for example, like, climate activists. It's not the same, of course, as kidnapping people, but they do often, of course, break the law or damage property and things like that. And the government has to find a way of responding to these things as well. And it's the same also in many ways, in that the Red Army faction also enjoyed some sympathy from the public as well, not from everybody, not from the majority, but there were people kind of vaguely sympathetic towards their cause, especially again on Schmidt's side of the political spectrum, and he faced a lot of criticism for that. And also lastly, in terms of security, that was another big crisis that Germany faced at the time, looking at the fact that the Soviet Union was stationing more missiles in Europe. And it was actually Schmidt who pushed for the so-called NATO double track decision in 1979, which basically meant that more medium range nuclear missiles were stationed in Germany by the US. And the result of this was basically that you had the largest, or some of the largest, demonstrations in Germany ever emerging out of this, and also the emergence of the Green Party as a sort of pacifist response to all of that. So it's very interesting. He's another example of somebody who kind of had his own ideas, had his own mind on certain things, and was trying to solve the crises of the day, you know, basically following his own political instincts as opposed to those of his party or those of the advisors around him.
There's an obvious question here, right? Which is that while all this is happening in Schmidt's native Hamburg, there's a young law student and rising star in the local youth wing of the SPD called Olaf Scholz, who is a long way to the left of Schmidt on a lot of issues, especially on NATO.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Scholz has come some way back towards the centre since those days. How much do you get the sense that Scholz has sort of studied the leadership style of Schmidt and learned from it?
It is an interesting question, given that, you know, this was at the same time as Scholz called NATO an imperialist venture, you know, and was sort of very, very critical of that stance. And you know, the deputy leader, I think, of the Young Socialists as well, so the youth movement the youth wing of the SPD. So at the time, I doubt that there was much studying of Schmidt going on. If anything, it was probably more to see, you know, how to pull the SPD back onto the left-hand side of the political spectrum. I'm not sure entirely. I mean, Schmidt is obviously hugely revered in Hamburg itself, and also often ranks among the more popular of Germany's post-war chancellors. But at the same time, I think there was even at the time a lot of criticism of this kind of very stubborn, you know, thing that he did, kind of sticking to his own ideas and pushing them through. So I'm not entirely sure that this is Scholz's style as well. I mean, I know at times he comes across as, you know, very aloof and kind of making up his own mind before he even speaks to anybody else. But I think that's a different thing from Schmidt, who often came across as kind of in public as very vocal as well, which is less so the case with Schmidt, with Scholz, who comes across as more, you know, sort of reserved and holding back almost. What do you think?
I have to admit, I have cheated a bit on our fourth and final chancellor. We are inevitably going to discuss Angela Merkel, the crisis chancellor par excellence. But instead of foisting my own half-baked theories on the listeners, I'm going to bring in an expert witness who knows the ins and the outs of those years better than almost anybody else on the planet.
Is it Richard David Precht?
No. I think we could do a bit better than that. Today's guest will be a familiar figure to many of our listeners. Peter Altmaier grew up in a working-class family in the Saarland, a small but politically distinguished Bundesland on Germany's border with France, and studied jurisprudence at its state university. He initially worked as a senior official in the European Commission, and then in 1994, he was elected to the Bundestag for the CDU, rising to become chief whip in 2009, then federal environment minister in 2012, succeeding Norbert Röttgen, whom we spoke to about Germany and China in the last season of this podcast. 18 months later, Herr Altmaier was promoted to lead Angela Merkel's chancellery, overseeing the machinery of government and contacts with some of the most powerful figures in the world during the latter stages of the Eurozone crisis, the first Russian invasion of Ukraine, the European migration crisis of 2015 and 2016, and the Brexit referendum. From 2017 to 2021, he was subsequently the Federal Minister for Economics and Energy, introducing Germany's first industrial strategy and working on the response to the COVID crisis. Herr Altmaier is also an enthusiastic student of history and has one of the most beautiful collections of antiquarian books I have ever seen outside an institutional library. Herr Altmaier, welcome to the New Germany.
Morning.
Herr Altmaier, you and Angela Merkel have both read a great deal of history. Against this background, how much did you have a sense of dealing with an exceptional period of overlapping crises during your time as Chancellery Minister and Economics Minister? And what specific lessons did you and the Chancellor draw from these historical precedents?
Certainly, during my period as a minister in the Chancellor's office, I certainly felt this sense of historic imminence and importance. But from a purely historical perspective, it was not so much different from the past. Remember the Napoleonic Wars, the foundation of the German Empire in 1870, the First and the Second World War, the threat coming from Adolf Hitler and his regime from Germany to other neighboring countries in Europe and across the world. And even during the post-war period between 1950 and 1990, there have been numerous crises around the world. Nevertheless, I think that something has changed over the last 30 years, and that is exactly that after the end of the Cold War, we have seen also an end of the bipolar world order after the Second World War. The U.S. and former Soviet Union as two strong opponents, but also partners, dealing with each other and China, that is part of the past. It is part of history. And when you look at the events, the evolution of politics since the end of the Cold War, I think you can identify three main structures. One is we have less unilateral leadership than before. Our American allies from time to time seemed to be a little bit tired, leading the world, policing the world. But the Europeans were not in a position to fill the gap that was left by our American friends. The Soviet Union disappeared, and it has opened new perspectives for many countries around Soviet Union, inside Soviet Union. But at the same time, Russia went from a country looking for more democratic structure, slightly but steadily, to a country with authoritarian regime and threatening again its neighbors. And we have seen since 9/11 a new situation in so far that the crisis has become the new normal. It's not an exceptional situation, but the fact that we are all living in a globalized world, that we have seen an enormous increase of international trade, that most of the problems we are facing, from climate change to COVID-19, have a global scale. That means that we are in a permanent modus of crisis, not just in Germany, but also in the US, in the UK, in France, and other countries worldwide. And we have to adapt to a situation where crisis never ends, and where you have to handle multiple crises at a time. For example, the refugee crisis and the second euro crisis in 2015. For example, nowadays, the Russian war of aggression against Ukraine and the terrorist attack of Hamas against Israel at a time. I could add more examples to that.
And as someone with a historical mind who clearly looks back all the way to the 19th century and the 20th century for kind of historical answers to problems, do you have a kind of favorite model, somebody that you look to? Is there a chancellor in German history who you think was best at managing crises?
This question, I believe, as a humble former politician, has to be answered by history and historians. But if you look back to our first democratic post-war chancellor, Konrad Adenauer, he was on the one side in a much better position because Germany was not a global actor at that time. It had even not a full degree of sovereignty. But Adenauer was challenged by the enormous task to establish the first working and lasting democracy in Germany. And then after 9/11, of course, we had numerous military conflicts. May I recall you the American war in Iraq? May I recall you the NATO action in against Libya and its dictator Gaddafi? May I recall the refugee crisis I've already mentioned? And this is because it is a typical phenomenon after the end of the Cold War. It has no precedent in modern history. And therefore, it is so difficult to compare. But what I can say is that Angela Merkel's role has to be seen against the background of our close friendship and cooperation with countries like France, United Kingdom, and the US. Germany has always tried being part of the solution, not of the problem. That was not always easy. And as you can see, when the government resigned and was replaced by the new Ampel coalition, still some problems were left and not yet resolved.
During that long decade, when you worked closely with Angela Merkel at the apex of the German state, which of the crises, or it might be better to say, which of these periods of overlapping crisis did you find the most difficult and why?
It may be a surprise to you, but looking back, the most difficult certainly was and is the fight against the climate change. Why is it the case? Because we identified already in the 90s when Angela Merkel brokered with others the Kyoto Agreement, then we realized the urgency of joint action. We have done and achieved quite a lot over the last 30 years, but still not enough to succeed. And one of the explications why this enormous ambition did not achieve its aims properly is, of course, that so many other imminent crises have taken away public attention from the issue of climate change. That has always been the case during the Iraq war, during the Libyan war, during COVID-19, and many, many other crises. Personally, for me, the most challenging crisis of them all were the refugee crisis and the euro crisis in 2015. The refugee crisis, because it had two different aspects. One was the humanitarian imperative that we have omitted after the extremely cruel and unhuman civil war. Mr. Assad in Syria, with Russian support, has led against his own people and opposition. We had seen about 10 million refugees in that area without any perspective, without work permission in Turkey, Lebanon, or Jordania, without medical protection, without schooling and education for the children. And the question was how to deal with that. And I recall the situation in summer 2015, when every day, for almost half a year, more than 7,000 people knocked on the European door, coming via Turkey to Europe, and most of them wanted to stay in Germany, and they did, by the way, actually. And we were challenged to find ways in coping with that on a domestic level first. That means providing humanitarian support, providing schooling, providing food, etc. But then, of course, also on the European and international level, and I remember that the EU-Turkey agreement that was brokered also by Germany and supported from the beginning was all but popular in Germany because we decided to help Turkey to provide humanitarian aid to its Syrian, Iraqi, and Afghan refugees on its territory. But it worked, and we were able to build an international structure that is working still today. One of the very few institutional arrangements with good effect for both the humans concerned and the stability of Europe and NATO on the other side. So I think we can learn from that for the future that solutions to international challenges, may it be refugees, may it be climate, may it be other challenges, have to be international. We have no chance in dealing with that in a unilateral way.
Robin Alexander, a political journalist who covered the Merkel era very extensively, described her style of crisis leadership as radically reactive. The Chancellor herself is once reported to have used the phrase Aufsicht fahren, which is one of those German expressions that doesn't really slot into English, but means something like to proceed cautiously and with great attention to the danger signs immediately in front of you. How would you describe it? And what kind of leadership do you think the German public wants from a Chancellor in a time of crisis?
The image and the meaning of the notion of Chancellor has been largely defined by Otto von Bismarck in the 19th century. And it is seen as a success model. And we have been lucky enough in Germany, in post-war Germany, to see strong chancellors like Konrad Adenauer, Helmut Schmidt, Helmut Kohl, Gerhard Schröder, and Angela Merkel. But as a matter of fact, we have to realize that whoever is going to be a chancellor in the future, and whoever has been a chancellor in the past, has no free margin of maneuver to decide on the politics he or she would like to implement. So many things have been decided already by the predecessors. Others have to be discussed with coalition partners. We have, as long as we are, and we have always been, I think it's for the sake of the country, as long as we are so closely connected to the world economy and to the globalized world, then we have to be reactive. a government who is not listening and looking to the challenges coming from abroad, from other countries, from other regions, from other developments, but just sticking to its political party program and neglecting all the other issues, would not be in a position to develop a successful domestic European or international policy. That is my personal, very profound conviction, and it has been confirmed many, many times over the 30 years I have been in politics and the 20 years I had the honor to be part of Angela Merkel's team in different political functions. This is something we have to dare telling our people.
And given what you said about sort of reactive politics, the idea that you have to sometimes abandon your political program in order to deal with crises and do it swiftly, do you sometimes feel that some strategic mistakes were made in the process? And isn't it also an issue that when you're so preoccupied with kind of crisis management, that those kind of strategic problems, long-term things such as energy dependency on Russia, get neglected in the process? So in that balancing act, are there any decisions that you now regret were made at the time?
Well, first of all, as long as politicians have been in power since the end of the Stone Age, with the emergence of the first cities and states, everybody who took decision has been in danger of making mistakes. It is something you cannot exclude, because you have to take your decision on the basis of assumptions with regard to the future. And that is, of course, something that implies errors and that implies mistakes. And therefore, if we want to be fair and objective, then I think we have to compare each government with the previous governments of that country and each government with the neighboring governments in other countries in Europe, elsewhere in the world. And then you can say, oh, well, compared to others, it was worse or it was better. And it's not my role or not my duty to say how good or how bad we have been. The second point is that in Germany, we have had a decades-long debate on the role of the military in a democratic state. After the terrible war that was started by Adolf Hitler and that has devastated large parts of Europe and entire Germany, there was a so-called peace movement from the beginning of the 50s against militarization of Germany, as I have called it, against an army within NATO, against membership with NATO. And this is an indication that something went wrong in Germany, because no one of our neighbors was in similar trouble and was so much struggling with the idea whether it is okay to defend yourself and whether it is okay to have the necessary weapons to deliver. I remember when I was asked by Angela Merkel and Horst Seehofer, the then party chairman of CSU, to draft the election manifesto in 2017, included a chapter where I said, well, we will stick, if reelected, to the 2% target of NATO for defense expenditure. And when you look back, this was criticized by almost all other political parties except the liberals. It was criticized by social democrats, by the Linke, by the Green Party, as militarization of Germany. It was a point that Germany has decided under the government of Gerhard Schröder and Joschka Fischer from the Green Party to shut down all the nuclear power plants. That was 20 years ago. Then when Angela Merkel was chancellor, we have revised that decision shortly before the nuclear incident of Fukushima. And then 85% of the German population were explicitly against nuclear energy. And then the German parliament took a decision by almost unanimity to revise the prolonged activities of nuclear power plants, to shoot them down as originally envisaged, even 1 year earlier. And today we realized this was a German Sonderweg. And I always have argued in my political life and career that Sonderwege normally the wrong answer to real challenges. I was a little bit sad when I have seen in the COP conference, COP conference in recent days, that the United States and 30 other countries have established an alliance to revive nuclear power across Europe and across the globe to better protect the climate. Germany has managed to organize, with the help of others, an alliance to triple renewable energies. But I think, given the size of the problem to protect the climate, wouldn't it have been better to say, let's come together and let's say tripling renewable energies and extending and preserving nuclear energy as long as it is needed to reduce CO2 emissions around the globe? So sometimes we need a cross-party consensus, as the Americans say, bipartisan consensus. And this is a challenge that we always tried to meet in the past, during the refugee crisis, during the euro crisis, when it was about social reforms in Germany. And my impression is that we have, after the Russian aggression against Ukraine, we have a little bit forgotten how to broker compromises that will bring us a decisive step forward and will increase the chance of success.
We only have a couple of minutes remaining, but I would like to ask a final question quickly that involves a bit of a change of gears. Over the past few years, we've seen a number of present and former political leaders begin to speak more openly about the toll that responsibility for managing crises has taken on their lives. How does it affect you?
First of all, thing I've never been, fortunately, and it was not my merit, never been in a serious health crisis in all these challenging years. In 2019, when we negotiated the transit of Russian gas through Ukraine in the interest of Ukraine and on the demand of Ukraine, in my ministry in Berlin, I suffered from a blood infection and didn't know, so I managed to conclude the negotiations. And then the doctors in Charité told me how dangerous this has been for my health. At the end of our time in government, I must admit, my health was not affected, but I felt a little bit tired. I felt a little bit tired because even the politicians from time to time need a day off or a holiday. And this is, in most of the cases, not possible because the crisis does not respect your personal holiday calendar.
Thank you to everyone who has joined us for this new series of The New Germany. Over the next few weeks, we will turn to political extremism, the country's social transformation, the present and future of the German industry, and relations with France and the United States. In the meantime, please write to us with your questions, reflections, and vitriol on the social media network formerly known as Twitter, assuming the whole thing hasn't imploded by the time this episode comes out. We are at @Hoyer_cat and at @OliverNMoody.
I just can't bring myself to call it X. It just sounds like a teenage boy's dream of a social media app.
That's because it practically is.
And above all, we would like to thank our friends at the Körber Stiftung, whose History and Politics podcast, of which this is a part, has a whole Aladdin's Cave of other episodes available in both English and German, and whose publications on everything from artificial intelligence regulations to the health of democracy can be found at www.körber-stiftung.de.
Until next time from Norfolk.
And lebt wohl aus Berlin. See you soon.